Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Local author Robin Solomon is a nurse educator at Enloe Health, formerly Enloe Hospital, and she teaches nursing at Chico State University. Before her career in nursing education, she worked as a reporter for a daily newspaper in Hobbs, New Mexico, and as a second grade teacher. Robin Solomon has now written a novel, and one of the characters is a nurse who works on the night shift and is mother of teenage twins. The title of this book is Altered Awakening. Robin Solomon, welcome.
Thank you.
You've got such a varied background. You were a reporter and you're a second grade teacher, and now you're a nurse educator.
Yes, it's been kind of a full circle. Started out English and journalism major in college and really always have loved to write. And I started working as a newspaper reporter in the education department, decided I want to go back to school and become a teacher. So started teaching second grade and did that for 9 years. And when we moved to Chico, I decided I wanted to go back to school to become a nurse. It had always been a dream of mine as well. Did that. And now I'm teaching nursing, so it's kind of that full circle.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that because I think, don't we have a shortage of nurses here in Chico or generally?
Generally, we do. It's a little more impacted here in Chico since we have the two colleges.
Yeah.
But yes, that we always need great nurses.
So thank you for that. Now, you have this book, and it's a novel, and I notice writers usually in the front of their book say the characters and events portrayed in this book are fictitious. And I thought, boy, did that not need to be said? You start reading this book and you say, oh my goodness, is this ever fictitious? But the next page in your book is a page that a lot of readers don't, they pick up the novel, they start reading chapter one. I looked at your dedication and it says, to my amazing kids, Sammy, Ashley, Nick, and Tyler. And I thought, oh, that's nice. But I start reading the book, and I thought, oh, Sammy is a character in your book. But you also say in your dedication, you're talking about your children now. You're my constant inspiration and joy. Your laughter, curiosity, and creativity remind me every day why stories matter. And I thought, oh, most people would think stories don't matter, particularly fiction. So why do you say that stories matter?
I think that stories are important. They're important for children. It helps to inspire their imagination and their creativity. My kids always loved when I read them stories, read them books when they were little. And I think that, you know, one of my main inspirations for publishing, I've always written. Ever since I was in fifth and sixth grade, I've written books. But one of my main inspirations for finally moving forward in publishing was to show them that it is important to follow your dreams. Stories matter. Goals and dreams and hopes all matter. And I want them to be inspired by that so that they know they can always achieve anything they want to.
And it seemed like you aimed your novel at young people.
Yes, it's a young adult novel initially, and although I have had quite a few people tell me they enjoy that type of superhero type thing, but yes, definitely wanted to gear it toward younger adults.
My guest is Robin Solomon, and she has written a novel. The title is Altered Awakening, and I mentioned reading your dedication, but I could barely get past the cover. I stared at this cover and stared and stared, and I would read a while, and I would go back and stare at the cover. And it is so realistic that I wondered, and I looked for who gets the credit for this. I couldn't find any human with credit. So I was wondering if this is AI-generated.
It is not AI-generated. I actually, initially when I went to publish my book, I went with a publishing company, and they had an artist who created that. I purchased the cover from them. And I had some ideas of what I wanted it to be and just kind of fed them that information. And we had a couple different covers to choose from.
For the listener's sake, would you describe your cover?
Sure. Yes, it is. The main characters are the twins, Sammy and Stone, and so they're on the cover. And then there's a man kind of in the shadows standing over them. And not to give too much away, but he is a scientist who actually had a hand in their creation.
There's a story right there. So when I look at these young people, they look the age, the characters in your book, they look just like that age. And then there's this figure lurking in the shadows. And he doesn't, his expression is scary. But I also was looking at the color of these young people's eyes, because in the story, the young girl has green eyes. And on your cover, she has very clear blue eyes. Did I misread something?
You might have. I believe she has blue eyes and he has green eyes.
Yeah, well, in the story, they say hazel eyes.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, well, they look like they both have blue eyes. Yeah. Anyway, that was a minor detail. But I did find your cover really enthralling, to say the least.
Thank you.
Well, we've mentioned the one of the characters' name is Sammy, and that's not a young boy. Who are the characters in this story? Like, when you start telling, you tell us who some of the characters are going to be.
Yes. Actually, all of the characters, or I should say four of the characters, are named after my children. I had to include all four of them.
Yes.
So Sammy and Stone are the main characters, the twins. And then
Sammy, though, Stone is the boy.
The boy.
And that Stone, you don't have a child named Stone.
I do not, no.
So you just like that.
I like that name, okay. Yes. It kind of just came to me.
And then Sammy is Samantha.
Samantha, okay. Yes.
So we meet these two. Who else do we meet in chapter one?
Chapter one, you hear about Samantha, Sammy's best friend, Ashley. And they have,
also is one of the names of your children.
Yes, yes. And they have gotten in a big fight over a boy, as friends sometimes
teenagers,
do.
Yes,
yes,
very teenagers.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And so she's really upset, and she doesn't really know. They've lived, you know, near each other for a really long time since they were little, and just hates fighting with her best friend. So she wants to go talk to her mom about it.
Aha, so there's another character.
Yes.
Her mother, and she says, Sammy says, I need to talk to my mom about this, because she sounds like Ashley really hates me.
Yes.
And they've been best friends.
Yes, yes.
So we meet these two young women, and she's saying she needs to talk to her mother. And at the end of that chapter, Sammy felt her blood turn to ice. She hears her mother's voice and her blood turns to ice, but she loves her mother.
Well, she also hears her mom in her bedroom. She hears her upstairs and downstairs.
And this is something that I notice. I can just imagine a mother or dad telling bedtime stories, and they get to what seems like the end, and then they don't tell what happens next. And then... Oh, you'll have to wait till tomorrow evening. I'll tell you more tomorrow evening. Or Saturday evening movies, Saturday afternoon movies, like the cowboy would be hanging on a cliff and you don't know, you have to come back next Saturday. So when we're reading your book, we get to the end of a chapter. Oh my gosh, I've got to read the next chapter. How in the world did that happen? So these are the characters in chapter one. I'm going to ask you, Robin, if you would read chapter two.
Sure. Sammy froze with indecision. She didn't know what to do. The angry woman, still muttering and throwing things around her mom's room, looked like her mother and sounded like her mother, but she sure didn't act like her. This thought helped Sammy make up her mind. She turned and ran downstairs, down to her mother's calm, normal voice. Mom, Mom, she shouted as she ran into the kitchen. She was running so fast that she slipped on the cool tile floor and skidded right into her mom's arms. Her mom laughed as she gently pulled her daughter off her and looked straight into her eyes. Honey, what is it? What's going on? Ashley is standing outside looking like she's ready to blow the place up, and you come running in here like somebody's chasing you. Catch your breath and tell me what's happening. We don't have time for that, Sammy said quickly, turning her mom away from the sink full of dishes and the kitchen window. She felt a pang of remorse as she caught a glimpse of Ashley standing in front of the house. She had a determined look on her face, as if she were trying to get up her nerve to confront her friend. "I'm sorry," Sammy silently said to her friend. "This is way more important right now." "Mom, you have to come with me," she continued, pushing her mom out of the kitchen and up the stairs. "There's something going on in your room. A woman was there. She looks like you and she sounds like you, but I don't know her. And she was so angry." Sammy continued to push her mom up the stairs toward the bedroom. Her mom slept alone in that room now, ever since her dad had died 4 years ago. Sammy tried not to think about her dad very much because it really saddened her. But in times like these, it was hard not to wish he was here to deal with things.
So just a second. Here's her mother. She's talking to her mother very sweetly. But she's saying, but Mom, you were upstairs. And we're reading this, and sometimes I have to go back and reread. Did I understand that? Is that what they really saying? Is that what really happening? So also in this chapter, we learn that she had lost her dad 4 years ago. So if Sammy's a teenager, the age, we don't know at the time, but the age turns out to play a role in the story. How old is Sammy when this story starts?
She is currently 15, about to turn 16. Yes.
Yeah, she's about to turn 16. Mm-hmm. And we later learn, oh, that's a significant time marker.
It is, yes.
Okay, so her mom wants to know. If you'd continue reading.
"What are you doing?" her mom asked, stopping in front of the door and turning to her distraught daughter. "Why are we here?" Sammy took a deep, calming breath before she began explaining to her mom what she had seen. The look of concern on her mom's face stopped her before she had completed the story. "Sammy, are you okay?" mom asked gently, reaching out to tuck a piece of curly brown hair behind her daughter's ear. "Nothing you're saying makes any sense." Sammy felt her anxiety rise as she saw that her mom didn't believe her. "I didn't make it up, Mom," she said. "Look, I'll show you." She reached out hesitantly toward the doorknob, pausing before quickly turning it and flinging open the door. Sammy gasped as she saw nobody in the room, but she heard something in the bathroom. She marched past her mom and was reaching for the knob to open it when it opened right under her hand. "Hey, Sambo," her brother said cheekily, walking out of the bathroom with a smirky grin on his face. "What's up? You look freaked." Without hesitating, Sammy reached out and grabbed her brother's face, squeezing it between her fingers. "What are you doing, Stone?" she hissed at him. "Where is that lady that was in here?" He flung her hand away, and the grin slid off his face. "What are you talking about?" he asked. Sammy noticed that he looked away from her when he replied and couldn't meet her eyes. "I'm the only one here right now." He continued out of the room, patting his mom on the shoulder and walking past her to his own bedroom at the end of the hall. Sammy felt her mom come to stand next to her, the concern radiating off her. She placed a comforting hand on her daughter's shoulder and squeezed it with affection, her warm eyes filled with love. "It's just Stone," she said softly to Sammy. "Nothing to get so worked up about. I've got to go down to finish those dishes before I start on dinner. Why don't you take a few minutes before you come down and we can talk to Ashley together? I'm sure we can work things out." She patted Sammy's shoulder before leaving the room and walked back downstairs. Sammy followed her to the door of the bedroom and studied her brother's doorway at the end of the hall. Something was going on, something that worried her. She and Stone had always been close, best friends as well as twins. Lately, he had been kind of distant from her, as if he was worried about something. But Sammy always felt that they had each other's back. She was sure her brother knew more about the mysterious woman than he was letting on. "Why won't he talk to me?" she asked herself. "We always tell each other everything." She felt a tear slip out of her eye and quickly brushed it away. "I'm not going crazy," she thought. "There is something going on, something that Stone knows about. And I'm going to find out what it is," she told herself as she turned and slipped into her own bedroom.
Robin Solomon is reading from her novel, Altered Awakening. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, nurse educator Robin Solomon, whose book is Altered Awakening. These twins are talking to each other, and they were on good terms with each other. But Sammy, the sister, thinks, something's worrying my brother. I don't know what it could be. And then she says, he won't talk to me about it, and we've always told each other everything. There's something going on. He knows about it, and I'm going to find out what it is. So we as readers, what's going on? What's he worried about? And what's going on that Sammy is thinking, am I crazy? Because you begin to wonder as a reader, she must be crazy. She's hallucinating. So this chapter, again, is in with these questions about why won't he talk to me, and something's going on. So we as readers are left, I got to read the next chapter. So one thing that I enjoyed about your book, too, is I had to keep reminding myself this was fiction because they are in Chico, these young teenagers in Chico. But then as the story proceeds, they go to Paradise and Oroville and Corning. And so we have to keep reminding ourselves, these are fictional characters, but they're going to all these real places.
Yes. Yes. I wanted to write about something I knew, and I'm familiar with the area. And so I thought it was kind of fun to bring that little piece into it.
Yeah, I think it makes it more alive for us readers.
Yes.
If we know all these places, it's taking place right here. These characters must be real. Now, there's something that we learn, and I guess we have to tell the listeners that what they do learn is that they are test tube babies.
Yes.
And they didn't know that.
No, they did not.
This comes as a surprise to them, and they learn that they're not the only ones.
Yep.
How many of these test tube babies are there?
Well, there's quite a few. There's a whole group of them that were created by this scientist. He helped their parents get pregnant, and there's a lot that's happened to some of them, and
Well, they have abilities that, now some of them you may have heard of, some of them, metamorphosis, what? But telepathy? One of these kids has telepathy, and we have heard of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In fact, our military sometimes uses people who have weird abilities to spy on our enemies. So they have superpowers, so they're sometimes referred to as super babies. But when do they get these special abilities?
They show up around the age of 16.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that's why the timing of this story is important. Sammy's about to turn, and they're twins, mm-hmm. about to turn 16, mm-hmm. and they're learning, we've got special abilities. Now, you mentioned this guy on the cover that looks rather sinister, and stories like this, we kind of expect to have a bad guy,
mm-hmm.
and boy, is he ever.
Yes.
So who is this guy on the cover that we don't like?
This is Dr. Thelonious Jasper. He is the doctor who helped all of these parents have children. So he had an ulterior motive in doing that.
Yeah. And so some of the, Stone has this ability. He had a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And after this car accident, he had the ability, metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another character, and he thought he was going crazy.
Yes.
I mean, I think I would too if this happened to me. And so did Sammy.
Yes.
We must be going crazy. So metamorphosis was Stone's ability.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a character named Morgan. I mentioned telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
We heard of that.
Yeah.
Possible. I mean, he could read minds.
Yes.
So this young super baby,
mm-hmm.
Could read minds. There was another one that was interesting. A character named Allison could control water.
Yes.
How did she do that?
She can control water with her mind. She can move it. She can lift it. She can make it fly through the air. Yes.
And turn from ice to...
Mm-hmm. Melt it.
And then there was another character named Daisy who was a dreamwalker.
Yes, that was one of my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Yes,
yeah, I enjoyed writing that one.
Yeah, and that comes up, the character, one of your children is named Tyler, and one of the characters that we like and we feel for, oh,
yes.
gosh, Tyler, did that really happen to Tyler?
Yes.
I don't want to give away what happens to Tyler. but now, these parents, really, it turns out, it sounds like they've made a deal with the devil. This Dr. Jasper is really a bad guy.
Yeah.
And so these parents make a deal with the devil, and this doctor killed the parents.
Yes.
Maybe I shouldn't give away too much.
That's okay.
But there's another guy. If Jason's parents are dead, he is cared for by his uncle.
Yes.
And this uncle, oh, we just love Uncle Jim.
Yes.
And Uncle Jim helps solve these mysteries of what's going on because he has a lab. He can take blood samples.
Yes.
And test their blood and say, what in the world is going on with these teenagers?
Yes. So they definitely rely on Uncle Jim a lot to try to help figure out exactly what's going on with all of them.
Did your background in nursing play a role in...
I think it did. I mean, there's that looking at science and experimentation and what happens when it goes too far and what is too far. So I think it played a role in it. Yeah, in that side of it. And then also, too, I think as a nurse, I see people at their most vulnerable time. And in addition to that vulnerability, though, I also see a lot of strength. And so I wanted to kind of convey that mixture of vulnerability and strength in my characters.
So these characters, we feel sorry for them sometimes, but we admire them. And here they are, just teenagers.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Now, your own children are past teenage years now.
Yes, they're young adults. They're young adults, yes. But...
Well, it's been quite an interesting read, even as an older adult.
Thank you.
And like I say, I found myself just staring at these young people on the cover of your book. So thank you for putting this book together and having this idea of why stories matter.
Yes. Thank you. And book two. Book two is coming soon
in
the series.
So stay tuned.
Yes.
My guest has been Chico author Robin Solomon, and her novel is Altered Awakening. After a break, I'll be talking to author Emily Gallo about her latest novel, Singing for Change. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest grew up in Manhattan, then lived in San Francisco, Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, and Seattle during the 60s and 70s. In 2006, she retired from teaching, and Emily Kaufman became Emily Gallo when she married David, a professor of economics, and moved to Chico. She has now published her 10th novel, Singing for Change. This book explores themes of grief, resilience, and social justice through music. It features a reclusive 60s musician who helps turn tragedy into a rallying cry. Emily Gallo, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, the cover of your book has this really interesting artwork, and I looked everywhere to see, Well, who created that? And I couldn't find a name.
Well, Glenn Tucker, who is the person who actually wrote the song at the end as well, he was my piano teacher when I first moved here. And he's an audio producer, and he's done my the production of me reading the book for audiobooks, and he's also able to do all this on a computer. So, we discussed it.
You might describe it. Of course, the title, Singing for Change, and there's a figure there.
And it's a line drawing of a man with a guitar on a stool, and then the musical notes coming through. And he managed to get the G of the change looking like the G clef. So I don't know how he does it, but he's very talented.
So that was fun before I even opened the book. And your prologue is shocking. But, you know, day by day here in our country, this kind of thing is...
That's why I wrote this book. I mean, I actually started this book as Dutch, wanting to get back into one of my characters. And he owned a pot farm in Garberville, California. And he was a musician in the 60s, and he still wrote songs. And he made quite a bit of money and still makes money on his royalties.
And so your main character is based on a real person that you knew, or no?
No, it's all my characters are based on about 10 people I know all put together. Yeah. I was going to write about him just getting back into music, and then I just got so wrapped up in all these terrible mass shootings that I decided to kind of change it a little bit and... That's how the book turned out.
So that's what I thought. You probably started with the idea, and then it's like a flashback because this is not in chronological order. So why don't you read your prologue for us?
A man pulled into a handicapped parking spot in a garage at Los Angeles International Airport. He didn't have a special license plate or placard, but no matter. He wasn't coming back for his car anyway. He shut off the engine and started emptying the two large pockets of his cargo pants, taking inventory of everything he needed, and thus assured put everything back in his pockets. He pulled the brim of his cap down low over his eyes, got out, and started walking towards the terminal entrance. His cargo pants swung with each step, the objects within making dull metallic sounds. It all made him feel conspicuous, and he started to sweat and gulp at the stale evening air. His knees felt weaker with each step, but he bent his head lower and forced himself along. This was no time to stop, to think. He stuffed his hands in his pockets to quell the noise so obvious to him, so lost onto the world around him. Ahead, the traffic crawled around the terminal, and as he approached the curb, a gap between cars appeared. He stepped into the traffic because God was clearing the way for him. Yes, it was a sign. He kept walking, empowered by the cars nosing down for him. He leaned forward, making his way to the doors to baggage claim. A woman held the door open for him. He could tell her sex by her shoes, the energy of her smile that faded to a tisk as he ignored her courtesy. For a split second, he considered her for his first victim. But no, that would throw him off his big scene. He stopped and studied the crowd milling around the luggage carousel, choosing for best effect. The one who towered over everyone, the woman in a man's suit. He pulled the guns out of his pockets, slipped in the magazines, and started firing.
This is my guest, Chico author Emily Gallo, and she's reading from her book, Singing for Change. And we don't know who this person is who walks into the airport at LAX. And then you take us back to introduce the characters that we're going to get to know in this book. So why don't you read... or just tell us, who is this person? You mentioned somebody named Dutch, And yes. Who is he?
Well, Dutch has been a character in a couple of other of my books.
That's what I found amusing, that often you come take us
I
back
always,
to your previous
I always have characters.
Novels.
Yeah. And that, you know, each one might be the protagonist of one and then just a small part of another. But he's pretty major in this book. And he's an old 60s musician who owned a pot farm in Garberville. And he decides to get back into music. And he's the one who organizes what ends up happening after this horrible.
So we meet some of the people there on his farm, and we're we meet this other old, he's in his 80s, musician, this black guy named Buster, and I found it amusing. He's from Mississippi, so he if he has a chance to eat ribs, barbecued ribs, that's his choice, and I thought, now, how did Emily know that? Because Mississippi is right there near Memphis. Memphis is headquarters, maybe, of barbecued ribs. How did you know that?
Well, I've done a lot of traveling across the country. I know about. And if you remember my book, Bardo, where that was basically food coming across the country and eating various things and, of course, ribs in the South.
Even the way he pronounces New Orleans.
Right.
New Orleans. Yeah. But now there was something that I thought, Emily must have made that up, because I grew up in the South eating pecan pie. And you have your character, well, they talk about pecan pie, but he was going to get peanut pie?
Well, you know my good friend Rafiki.
Oh, yes, yes.
He is somebody that I just talk. He comes over to Tin Roof and meets me once a month or so, and we talk about whatever book I'm writing. And he's the one who introduced me to the idea of peanut pie, which I, too, had never heard of.
In fact, I asked another friend of mine who lived in California almost all her life, and I said, have you ever heard of peanut pie? She said, no, never heard of that. And I said, well, I actually looked it up, and there was a recipe for it. She says, oh, I'd like to have that recipe.
Well, you know, I had him buying it at a certain place in Crenshaw, and I researched to make sure that there was a bakery that had peanut pie.
Peanut pie. We mentioned that, so it starts out in Garberville, a pot farm, and you had a book about that. But now you have them start driving toward, down to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And he says, well, we're going to make a stop at the Columbarium. And the first time I ever heard that term was the book I read that you wrote about the Columbarium. So you have your characters visit the Columbarium, and for people who haven't read your previous book, what in the world is that?
Columbarium is a place where people put their loved ones who die, their ashes, in niches. And the one in San Francisco, they have them all over the world, but the one in San Francisco is this incredibly gorgeous building, and they're very interesting. You know, a lot of people would just put flowers or a picture of the person and the ashes in an urn and leave it at that. But the one in San Francisco has such interesting things in each columbarium, in each niche, that when I wrote that book, I just created characters based on what was in those niches.
And you're referring to them as niches, but then there are some, he refers to as apartments.
That's Jed, my character.
Your character.
He's the caretaker, shall we say, of the columbarium, and he's the one who has called them apartments and condos if they're particularly big.
Yeah, if
and
they're
have
bigger.
More than one person in it.
Condos and apartments. Now, a previous book, too, you had this child found out on her own, and she didn't have parents, and she was adopted. So here, who is that? She reappears in this story.
And she was actually found at the Columbarium in the another book I wrote called Murder at the Columbarium.
Murder at the Columbarium.
Yeah.
So this character was adopted. Another thing you have in your book is plays a role in that rent is very expensive here in California, particularly places like the Bay Area, Southern California, rent is very expensive. Child care is very expensive. How do people afford this anymore? And so how do your characters afford the outrageous rent and child care?
Well, the one couple, Malcolm was a foster child at the person who owned the house, and that's in another book, Venice Beach, that I wrote. And then when Miss Ruthie died, she left the house to Malcolm. So they have the house, but then they have taxes and insurance, and it's expensive. So they decide to get a roommate, and Graciela, who is the sister of another main character of another book, Dreamer, that I wrote, moves in with them. And meanwhile, Asia, the little girl that was found at the murder at the Columbarium and murder at the Columbarium, is also living there with these.
And I might mention it's spelled A-J-A because
correct.
People might hear, what, the continent?
Yeah.
So these characters then, we get to know them and their personalities. But there's one personality that, I don't know what to make of this character, from Samoa.
Savali.
And I thought, well, there's an unusual name. And you have a family member.
Well, my cat we named. But the thing about Savali in the Samoan culture, and this was also in another book that I wrote, that they have a thing called fafafine, which is a third gender. So it's not like transgender. It's in some cases the family decides they want a woman, for example, as a child. So they decide
they
to make
her be a girl.
To be a girl. So they decide they're going to bring up the child as a girl. In other cases, the person who is fafafine just goes back and forth. Sometimes they're a man, sometimes they're a woman. So, and this is truly in the Samoan culture. I did a lot of research.
I wondered about that because when I was reading it, I thought, that sounds so bizarre.
Yeah.
But I thought you probably researched it.
Yeah, so that's what Savali is. And sometimes she's a woman, sometimes she's a man. But Malcolm fell in love with the woman of her and because Malcolm was straight. And he loves her enough that he puts up with her,
accepts
whatever,
her.
Accepts
him.
Her for or him for whatever
and,
she is at that day.
And I know cats is sometimes hard to tell what gender a cat is. So,
well, my dog actually found this tiny cat was probably I don't know 3 or 4 weeks old, and we brought it home, and we didn't know whether it was a girl or a boy because they're so little. So we named it Savali, and then when we took it to the vet, they said, well, it's a male. A female. So it's like, okay, well, Savali could be either one, so
so
works
you
out.
Have your character with that name. And now we already know that these characters get involved in this horrible, horrendous shooting at the airport. And there's another character that we haven't mentioned that plays a role in this, and his name is Elijah. And who is Elijah?
Elijah is a LA Clippers basketball player, and that's the tall man that
you
I
might
referred
expect
to
a
in
basketball
the prologue.
Player.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
you might
he
expect.
Was at the airport, and that was in that prologue when I said
in the prologue, you don't mention his name, but
no,
you do mention him being tall,
tall.
And, of course, a basketball player, you
right.
expect to be
right.
very tall.
And then the other character, that's Vivian.
Yeah, we haven't talked about Vivian.
And going back to where Dutch and Buster are coming down to L.A. to play in Playing for Change, which is what's obviously I named the book Singing for Change, play on that word. But that's something that probably a lot of people know about. It's their videos of musicians playing all over the world, and they edit them and put them together, and it's They're wonderful. If you don't know about it, go on YouTube and find them because they're incredible to watch.
And so Savali is from the Samoan culture, and Vivienne speaks French.
She's from Haiti.
She's from Haiti.
And she's an audio producer for the Playing for Change.
So they're going to have this event, and they've asked this old musician, this 80-year-old blues player from Mississippi. He's invited, and Dutch, of course, he's very famous. He made enough money that he could just live off his income from his music. And so here's this tall basketball player, and it comes in handy for people to be able to recognize you because he gets some extra privileges that an ordinary person might not get. So this Vivienne is there at the airport also. These various characters that we've just mentioned find themselves at LAX.
She is, besides being the audio producer at Playing for Change, she is also a reporter for Haiti Liberté, which is a big newspaper in Haiti. And she was on an assignment, and they're all... And Savali, we should go back, is also a spokesperson for the LGBTQ plus community. Yeah. And she does speeches and goes to try to organize people in different places. So
she's one of the organizers. Savali is one of the organizers from this event that she wants to sponsor. And it's a fundraiser. And now people might wonder, well, how does this work? But I think people remember We Are the World, where all these famous singers and musicians got together. And that's, in my imagination, that's what this was.
Yes.
That they were planning.
Yes, they were planning to have a, after the shooting, that they decided to have a kind of anti-gun or anti-violent, gun violence, I should say.
That their bond and their healing were going to take center stage at an anti-gun music festival organized by Dutch, this musician who had been able to retire to his pot farm because of his income.
And he had obvious, he was sought after, he has connections and was able to get a lot of people there.
And younger people may not realize the 60s and 70s in the Bay Area in particular were so different from the 50s. I thought back, oh my gosh, the 50s and the hippie culture and love and peace and all these elements that were.
And many music festivals.
Oh, yeah.
Music was played a huge role right.
in that period in our history.
And that's where Dutch is coming from. That's his history.
So, since he wasn't at the airport, he is trying to find out, well, what happened to these friends of mine? Where in the world are they? And how are they doing? Did they suffer? Now, Elijah is a basketball player. If a basketball player gets shot, that could end his career. So where was, I just gave away the fact that Elijah was shot. Where was he shot?
He was shot in the arm, which one would think would make a difference, but it turns out he might be okay, but the three of them were shot, Vivienne, Savali, and Elijah. And there's a lot of, and I tried to talk about that too, a lot of depression and anger and, you know, a lot of going through. Even if they get well physically from being shot, there's a lot of mental.
Well, and just the friends and family members who weren't there, didn't witnesses, how are they going to find their family member? Where is he or she? Which hospital? Did they take him to the hospital? Did they survive? What condition were they in?
And there were a couple of days or, you know, several hours where they didn't know anything.
And so I, as a reader, were thinking, oh, my gosh, this is probably what it's like with these things that we have happening that family members don't know. Did my child make it out of school before the shooter was shooting people?
I envision, these shootings when the parents are frantically on the street. Was it my child?
Yeah. That's how I felt as a reader when I was reading this. what happened to these, and how did their family find them even, or find what condition they were in? In fact, Vivian, they didn't even know, is she, they thought, well, I guess I gave away the fact that she survived, yeah. But they didn't know. They thought she was dead.
Yeah, and it's,
when they took her out of the airport.
She was hurt quite badly.
Seriously.
Yeah, quite seriously.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's trying to understand what causes, you know, what, that's what I was trying to do in the prologue.
Uh-huh.
What makes somebody want to do this? And then what happens to these people and their caretakers, their loved ones, how they have to, what they have to deal with.
And the child.
And the child.
You mentioned,
yeah.
Oh. And so did you reach any conclusions?
Well, if you'll notice, my books try to have happy endings.
Yeah.
That's just the way I am. So.
Well, would you read, there's a song. You end with a song.
Mm-hmm.
Would you just read the lyrics, or sing them if you want to. Sing or read the lyrics to this song that Dutch composes, because he is a musician.
That's right. It's called Save Our Children. To save our country, to do what's right, this is our time, this is our fight. Our children deserve a safe place to learn. Our children deserve a safe place to play. Keep our schools clean and safe. We stand tall every single day. To save our country, to do what's right, this is our time, this is our fight. Raise your voice, let it be heard against the weapons and the damage incurred. Let's rise above the hate and pain. Let's stand up, break the chain. Background checks and red flag laws, a waiting period to buy a gun. Assault weapons banned for the cause. Raise the minimum age to 21. There's a power in unity, and we'll protect our community. Let's stand together, hand in hand, strength in numbers. So take a stand to save our country, to do what's right. This is our time. This is our fight.
And this is your book, Emily Gallo. Emily is a local writer here in Chico, and her 10th novel is what she was just reading from, Singing for Change. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Robin Solomon, a nurse educator whose book is Altered Awakening. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Ensemble. Forest Avenue at dusk. Quill tips of two Italian cypress sway in the wind to Leonard Cohen's musky voice playing on my car radio. Dark green dancers with modest roots, 1,000 kisses deep. Lean left, then right. Talon branches performing a sad and beautiful ballet. I have learned miracles. When darkness tries to eat us alive, we suffer together in love. The world is broken to pieces, and stars write tiny glass poems. Towering silhouettes invite me to recover what I reach for in my secret life. Music, forgiveness, a ragged hallelujah. Danielle Alexic.
Forgiving her. Why did I not do this forgiving of that one, that love, so much sooner? We had much fun when we were together. Much to learn, much to share. We did learn and we did share so much heart. So not forgiving her. After all, when did I become so perfect? Well, not yet. Make this teaching part of that someday. As I look back, carrying around all that nasty energy, trash-talking my past lover, holding that in my precious life space for all these years, fool, I was, but this is truth. But now, no more hiding. can I truly tell myself and tell her how sorry I am? Yes, I just do that here. But that's not so much. More is here if I learn from this. Yes, that lesson. I didn't want to speak it. It was not in the first draft or in the second. But here it is in my face. I gotta take notice and write it down here, this time. I was unpleasant. I was unfair. I was unkind to both of us. I hid out in being right. That never quite worked. That was untrue. But I pretended I was right. I share the sorrow of our departing from what we had, leaving the relating without remaining friends, a sad choosing for me too, for my part too. I look and see it's all there. Lost opportunities for heartful connecting, gone forever. Our mutual loss. What more to say? Just this, a teaching moment. More yet, a learning moment. I take it in through time, all the time the lesson takes. Dare I say, such a gift. Less hate.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.